Tonight on Arena, we celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Beatles' first movie, A Hard Day's Night, and an exciting new acquisition for Dublin's Hugh Lane Gallery. Is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Yes, there it is, the immediately recognisable chord that started it all. It opens A Hard Day's Night, the song, the album and the film. But tonight it's the film that we're going to celebrate with leading Beatles historian Mark Lewisohn. It's 60 years since the Beatles got together with director Richard Lester to make their first film. A Hard Day's Night spans 36 hours in the life of the Fab Four, or at least a version of the Fab Four, as they make their way south by train to a London studio for a live TV performance, interacting with the public and the press along the way and trying to keep a character that we're told is Paul McCartney's Irish granddad out of trouble. This is certainly a witty showcase where we see four very individual personalities as well as the Beatles as a tight-knit gang. And there's a great soundtrack to boot. Delighted that Mark Lewisohn joins me on the line this evening to speak about this film. I was saying to you before we came to air, Mark, I watched this film again this afternoon. It's as fresh as a daisy, and in some ways all of the things that it does are as relevant today as they must have been absolutely mind-bogglingly new back in 1964.
Yeah, it really was a fresh blast of the new. Everything about the Beatles was, but this film was such a triumph. And 60 years on, it still is a triumph. And it's extraordinary that the Beatles, as a band and as their music, is still so incredibly fresh all these decades on, but the film as well. Everything they touched was gold.
Richard Lester was the director, and I think it was his idea here. A lot of people would have wanted to have made the first film with the Beatles. Why did they choose him?
They didn't exactly choose him, but what they did do was say no to some previous offers. One of the clever things about the Beatles, and there were so many, is they didn't only have the good sense to say yes to the right things, they had the very good sense to say no to the wrong things. and they took the risk that they would rather not be in a film at all than be in one that they were embarrassed about. And in those days, the few pop music films that there were, there were some honourable exceptions. Cliff Richard, a couple of good films were made by Cliff. But generally speaking, they were all quite hackneyed and formulaic. And they decided they'd rather not be in one of those. And they actually wrote to the screenplay writer, Alan Owen, and said, we would like to do a film with you. Now, he hadn't done anything in the realm of pop music before. He'd written quite tough, gritty dramas. But they liked him as a writer, and they said, we would like to do something with you. And that's how it came together. Mm. And in the end, the producer brought in Richard Lester, and the Beatles said, well, what's he done then? And the producer, Walter Shenson, said, well, he made a film called The Running, Jumping, Standing Still Film. And they went, that's our guy.
And what's extraordinary here, you know, they are great performers, but performing as musicians on stage is one thing. They're playing versions of themselves. And how many times have we seen somebody playing a version of him or herself and you think, that's nothing like you at all? They manage, all four of them, to give astonishing performances, acting performances.
Yes. I mean, they themselves put themselves down as actors. They said, you know, they would pretty much do one line at a time. But it's the way they handle it. It's their naturalness on the camera that is so stunning. Alan Owen wrote great lines for them. It did very much help that he was from Liverpool because he understood the cadences of Liverpool speech. But nonetheless, it was the way they delivered them. I mean, they were just so natural. And the consequence is you kind of forget that they're acting at all, and it's just like a film with the Beatles in it. It's not actually actors at all.
Let's listen to a clip which features, again, they're given some great lines here. This is a press conference along the way somewhere. And, you know, it could be a real Beatles press conference in many ways. Let's have a listen to that.
Tell me, how did you find America?
So I left to Greenland.
Has success changed your life?
Yes. I'd like to keep Britain tidy.
Are you a mod or a rocker?
No, I'm a mocker.
Do you think these haircuts have come to stay?
Well, this one has, you know. Stuck on good and proper now.
Frankly nice.
What would you call that hairstyle you're wearing?
Arthur.
There you go. What would you call the hairstyle you're wearing, Arthur? Yeah. I don't know which of them that is. I can't make out particularly. But you hear Ringo in the midst of that as well. Ringo Starr gets a really classy little section in this film. We're talking tonight, by the way, with Mark Lewison about A Hard Day's Night, the Beatles film, which is 60 years old this year. And Mark will be in the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire talking about this and other things, I'm sure, Beatles-wise tomorrow night. But Ringo gets a real section where there's some serious acting demanded of him, a kind of a sympathy that he has to evoke from the audience.
What happened was the writer Alan Owen decided that the storyline needed to spin off somewhere. It couldn't just be about the lives of these guys, 36 hours. So they have Wilfred Bramble, who plays Paul's grandfather, who's along for the ride. He's a king mixer, and he persuades Ringo that he shouldn't be put up with this position at the back of the Beatles on the drums where they're ignoring him. He should actually get out there and live a little bit. So he has this, the second half of the film is essentially Ringo goes AWOL and they have to kind of go looking for him. But he, in doing so, he has a lot to do and he does it so well. I mean, this is the guy who is quite unregarded as a Beatle, the guy at the back. I mean, he really was the fourth Beatle, if you like, in the way that people looked at them. But in this film, he's given the starring role and handles it so well. And in that press conference scene that you just played, those answers were ad lib. That was not scripted.
It wasn't even scripted.
Yeah, no, they were just ad lib because they handled press conferences so well.
Yeah.
That the writer, the director decided they would have one in the film, and they just did it.
and it has that kind of, it has that mockumentary feel as a result of that as well. But you mentioned there Wilfred Bramble, and I have to bring, he's a Dublin actor. He was born in Dublin. Steptoe & Son is where people will know him from. How well known would we have been at that time? I think Steptoe & Son was in its early days at that time, wasn't it?
Steptoe & Son had made a huge impact on British television from 1962, so he was very big from in 1964. I mean, and he was known as, you know, you dirty old man in Steptoe & Son, and that is why Alan Owen, as the writer, wrote these repeated references to how clean he was.
Yeah, everybody comes in and says, what a clean old man. You
know? Yeah, but that's because of the Steptoe reference.
Yeah. The other thing he does, and I don't know how scripted this is on the part of the script writer here, or how improvised it is, he's arrested at one point along the way and he gives the policemen that have arrested him a little bit of his mind. Let's have a listen.
Get me into the
training
room and
then
out come the rubber hoses.
Oh, there's a fire, is there?
You ugly great brute. You have sadism stamped all over your bloated British kisser.
Eh?
I'll go on hunger strike. I know you're a caper. The kidney punch and the rabbit clout. The third degree and the size 12 boot ankle tap.
What's he on about?
I'm a soldier of the Republic. You need the mahogany truncheon on this bio. A nation once again. A nation once again.
Oh, get Lloyd George over there next to the mechanic and the cloth couple. I'll sort this lot out, will you? Come on, Les, sit down over here.
There we have Wilfred Bramble as Paul McCartney's granddad, his Irish granddad, being brought into an Irish prison. But there is a link with them. The screenwriter had come to Dublin, hadn't he, to spend time with the Beatles while they were here?
Yeah, the arrangement was that he would spend time with the Beatles and get to know them and suss out their personalities and the way they spoke to one another and just kind of how, you know, get a sense of how he might write them in the film. And so he spent 3 days with them and more after that. But the initial period was 3 days and that began in Dublin in November 63 when they came over to play in Dublin and they stayed at the Gresham Hotel on O'Connell Street. And there was Alan Owen living with the Beatles for a few days just to, you know, pick up a sense of how they spoke. And he, of course, he did it really well.
There is that ongoing joke as well about North and South, North of England and South of England. That's a constant gag throughout the film.
Yeah, it is, because the Beatles, you know, they were Northerners and they considered anyone else to be soft Southerners. So there's a lot of that kind of talk in the film. When you stop and think about it, this was a U certificate, which was basically, you know, available to all. The Beatles were popular with everyone, but certainly the key base that they had was young people. And they're watching a film with these references. At one point, John Lennon sniffs a bottle of Coca-Cola. So he's basically sniffing Coke. If you don't know what he means, it just goes over your head. But there's all these little references in the film. But it is, at the end of the day, a brilliant family film.
The opening sequence is kind of extraordinary, where we hear the track, the title track of the album. And will you describe that opening scene, what we see across 2 minutes and 29 seconds?
The very first thing you see in the film, the very first thing you see and hear, is that chord at the beginning of Hard Day's Night. And with that chord comes Running. Three of the Beatles, John, George and Ringo, are running down a narrow street. I think it's meant to be Liverpool, but actually in reality it was shot in London, but it doesn't matter. They're running down a street being chased by their fans. And they're loving every second of it. They're grinning. And accidentally, George trips over Ringo's leg and goes sprawling on the ground. And Ringo falls over George. But they know they're being filmed, so they just get up and carry on running again, somehow without breaking step. And it's so exuberant. And then they run into a train station. And the reason Paul isn't running with them is he's already in the station with his Irish grandfather, Wilfred Bramble. And they're sitting in disguise, or Paul is sitting in disguise, reading a newspaper. And then eventually, you know, they dodge their fans in the station. It's frantic stuff. But they're quite laconic through it. You know, they only run when they need to. And then eventually they clamber aboard a train just as it's leaving the station. And that is how the film begins. It's a breathless start. And it gives the film that perfect tempo, and the energy level is set right high at the start, and it stays there all the way. And it really did. I mean, it was responsible for a complete upgrade in the way that these films could be made. The Beatles always came along and showed everybody how something could be done differently, because they didn't do things the conventional way. And here they are making a film, and it could easily have been average, and yet it was scintillating.
Not all of the tracks from A Hard Day's Night made it into the film itself, but the soundtrack to the film and the little snippets of other songs from other parts of the Beatles' previous existence, you know, they were still a very young band, obviously, at that stage. It's just gorgeous the way they're seeped in.
Yeah, they worked in perfectly. I mean, they made this film at a time of extraordinarily busyness. They were so industrious. They'd only just got back from America. They were doing TV specials. They were doing recording. They were doing radio shows, all at the same time as making this film. And the writing of the songs had been done in Paris when they were over there, and then in Miami Beach when they were over there just before the film began. But the quality was so high, you would think that, being that they were so exhausted, that they would actually flag in some way, but they didn't. They were young guys who just took it all in their stride, and they were up for hard work.
Yeah, well, it is an extraordinary watch. And just if anybody is going to the Pavilion tomorrow night, watch the film. I think you can get it on YouTube pretty much. Yeah, and just give yourself an hour and a half of total joy. We'll finish up. There's only one way to finish, I suppose, as the film starts, that opening sequence. It is a phenomenal song. It's even better when you watch the action, I think, with it, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, Hard Day's Night. I mean, even the title itself, what on earth did that mean? I mean, ultimately, it was an American film company that made this film, United Artists, and they went, what does it mean? Well, it didn't mean anything, but it meant everything, and it completely summed up the film.
It's been a hard
There we have it, A Hard Day's Night from the Beatles, and Mark Lewisohn will be at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary tomorrow night, the 14th of May, with Stephen Cockcroft and Jason Carty from the Nothing Is Real podcast, discussing 60 years of A Hard Day's Night and much else besides, I would guess. Full details on pavilionTheatre.ie. Choreographer Emma Martin is bringing her show Night Dances to the Abbey Theatre for this year's Dublin Dance Festival. The show is presented in a series of four vignettes, a celebration of dance culture from clubs to competitions to ceremonies. Performed to a soundscape by Daniel Fox from the Dublin post-punk and noise rock band Gillaband, it has atmospheric lighting by award-winning lighting designer Stephen Dodd. I'm delighted that Emma is with me in studio this evening. This you're bringing Night Dances to the Abbey this time around, but you had done this, Emma, the show in 2021 at the National Stadium. Very different type of venue. It struck me that the National Stadium, almost people could have been up dancing with you as much as anything else.
Yeah, hi Sean. Yeah, no, it's true. We wanted to go into a space where it didn't feel like a theatre space, and there wasn't that sort of barrier or separation between audience and playing space and the dancers. And when I went into the National Stadium, it's just got a feeling, you can almost feel the sweat in the building already and feel that like many things have taken place there. So it felt like the right space for it when we were making it, you know, that the audience would be on three sides and that they would almost be
part of the dance
in a way. Yeah. So this is a very different feeling to it, but the show hasn't really changed. Just, you know, I suppose the focus of the dancers is going in one direction rather than three.
Because you'd have had in the stadium, in the National Stadium, people, the audience wrapped around you to a certain extent.
Exactly.
So you would have choreographed it with some people facing one side, some people, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
Now everybody can face out front.
And dance away
to their heart's content. You mentioned you could almost feel the sweat when you walked into the National Stadium. I noticed in the publicity material, it talks about a sweaty love letter to dance.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Night Dances is made up of four little stories, essentially. The first of which, I think, involves quite a lot of sweat. Particularly on the part of your brother. The first sequence is called The Raver.
Yeah, well, it's actually the third sequence.
Oh, it's the third sequence.
It's called The Raver, and it's kind of based on a memory I have from when I was around 12, I suppose. My brother escaped to a rave that was in the SFX, and we lived in Meath, so that was quite an escape. Yeah, I don't know how he got up there.
What age was he at the time?
He would have been maybe 15. Going on 16. And my cousin was a sort of a house DJ in Dublin, quite a well-known one, and he was playing at this SFX, and he must have been staying with cousins or something. And my mum got wind of it, and I don't know, like, I remember driving up to Dublin with her. She was raging. And because the DJ, who was, you know, had quite a fan base, was her nephew, she didn't mind storming in and going,
It was Liam Dollard, I think, was the DJ.
It was Liam Dollard.
And probably give him a bit of a mind as well.
Yeah, totally. And it almost feels like a filmic scene in my head now, you know, I've romanticised it. But the scene was that there was these sort of swinging doors, and I got a glimpse of the inside, and it was just a sea of sweaty bodies, completely in a kind of euphoria of dancing. And I thought it was terrifying. At the age of 12, you see that and you're like, what's going on? But it stayed with me because it was such a strong feeling of, wow, like this is people dancing for pleasure.
And had you, what was your connection to dance, the 10 or 12 year old Emma?
Well, at that point I had decided I was going to be a ballet dancer, and I had just told everyone, this is what I'm doing, you may as well start treating me as a professional. and my parents sort of knew at some point I was going to leave the nest and go to a ballet school. And it was just such a strong decision that I'd made, like I really felt it very...
I'm guessing there was nobody on point in the SFX.
No, there wasn't, but it's just a really interesting crossroads in my life where I started to take dance really seriously and then I see this and I go, well, you know, and it did, I never forgot that moment.
Yeah, so there was more to it than the path you were taking.
Yeah, yeah.
That obviously stuck with you.
It did, yeah.
And it's finding itself, and it has found itself manifested in this particular show. Mm. Another of the vignettes is called God is a Girl. What's involved there?
So a group of seven young freestyle dancers who they dance competitively almost every week in various competitions around Ireland, in the UK and elsewhere. But it's mostly Ireland, UK and Sweden. And it's sort of, I suppose, a type of disco dancing. Right. It's massively athletic. And there's these young little things, you know, all in sort of glitz and sequins, absolutely throwing themselves around the room and doing the most incredible stuff. And so there's a school down in Carlow called Dance Republic. And I had worked with them a few years ago and made a show with teenage girls. And when I saw what they were doing compared to what I was, the choreography I was putting on them, I was so amazed by their ability and their passion. And it just reminded me of my past, you know, when I wanted to be a ballet dancer, just the amount of work that you put into it.
Yeah, because I think I saw maybe a section of this online today. It looked like five young dancers, possibly teenagers, or certainly not much older than teenagers.
No, barely even.
And what they were doing was, it was dance for sure, but it was also almost floor gymnastics, the kind of tumbles and turns and twists that they were doing.
Yeah, they're extremely acrobatic. And the group I have this year are between the ages of 10 and 12. So they're very, very young. And it's just, it's almost shocking when you see what they can do and the fierceness of their movement. So.
But you recognise that kind of fierceness and the type of physical discipline that's needed from your time training as a ballet dancer.
I did. And just in dance in general, I really, something about that virtuosity that I feel is just, it connects me to why I loved ballet, because, you know, it was so tight in its form that there's something about putting the body through that virtuosity and getting to another, I suppose, physical level. That I really respect, and just to see young kids do that is kind of incredible.
The music that you're using is so visceral. You know, you're talking about all of that energy and discipline. The music has that kind of quality in it as well. Who's doing the music? So and the music will be live in the Abbey, won't it?
Oh yeah, it's a live band, and it's Dan Fox from Gillaband, and then Jamie Highland is on drum machine, and Jamie's actually in the band Male. And then Brian Dillon, who's a musician under his own name, he's on synth. So yeah, I asked Dan to come and collaborate with me on this, because actually I'd been dancing to Dan's and Gillaband's music for many years, and just it kind of demands to be danced to, really, that sort of bass.
I've taken out of the final section that you sent into, the final excerpt that you sent into us, which has quite a bit of variety even across the about a minute of it. We'll hear quite a set of different sounds. Just some of the music, soundscape really is what we're talking about, from Daniel Fox from Gillaband, which is part of the show that we're speaking about this evening, Night Dances, with choreographer Emma Martin, who's with me in studio. And even as I said, Emma, across that 40 seconds we get quite a different, quite a variety of sounds within it. This is for a sequence in the show which is called Red, you were telling me as we were listening.
Yeah, yeah. So Red is a trio for three women, and it's performed by Aoife McAtamney, Robin Byrne, and Jessie Thompson.
Will they also be part of the God is a Girl, which is a quintet? I think it's five people, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's the deluxe version for the Abbey is seven kids.
So, all right.
Yeah, no, none of the sections cross over.
All right, they're all totally discreet and separate.
They are, yeah, but they have that thread of, I suppose, the sound, and it's almost sculptural, you know, in its kind of wall of sound.
And the final, and I don't know if it's the final one, but certainly the fourth of the sequences is called Lost Boy. Interesting inspiration that you got for this.
Yeah, yeah. This one, it was actually a story that stayed with me, that another choreographer, he was making a show about the Old Testament, and he came across this old Persian version of a story about Lucifer, who was thrown down from heaven. He was God's lover and was thrown down from heaven and created this really deep crack in the earth, and that became hell, and he existed in hell, and all he had was the echoes of God's voice. And there was something about that, and the kind of, I suppose I was thinking about anger and rage, and how, you know, dance as a instrument to, I suppose, sort of come through that, and
maybe to free the rage, or to express the rage in some way.
Yeah, in some way. So it's kind of, it's almost like a master of ceremonies sort of beginning to the show with this solo dancer.
Right.
Yeah.
I have to say it sounds like a very exciting prospect. Mm-hmm. So all four then are performed under that collective title of Night Dances with live music on stage in the Abbey. And I'm guessing too that the kind of set design and lighting design that you can get there is at a different level from what you could manage in the stadium, because you're on the stage.
It's true, although it's exactly the same design, because all of the light actually comes from this sort of halo like light box that myself and Stephen and Katie kind of came up with. So it's we're not really using much extra stuff from the Abbey except for the space and the
shape of the audience.
Yeah, there's a beautiful view onto the stage for dance, I think, in the Abbey.
Thanks a million for coming in to us, Emma. Emma Martin there talking to us about Night Dances, showing at the Abbey Theatre on Friday the 24th and Saturday the 25th of May as part of the Dublin Dance Festival. And you can find out full information on the Dance Festival website, dublindancefestival.ie. The Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin has just acquired a new work of art. It's by the French painter Edouard Vuillard, who, along with Maurice Denis and Pierre Bernard, were members of Les Nabis, or the Prophets, school of post-impressionists. The painting is called The Vuillard Family, of which we are going to tweet an image right now on at RTE Arena, so you can listen, see this as we're talking about it. It will hang in the same room as the gallery's other Vuillard painting, which is called Les Cheminées, part of the Hugh Lane Bequest. The Hugh Lane bequest of 39 paintings is shared between the Hugh Lane and the National Gallery of London. Back in the 1900s, Hugh Lane, frustrated over the housing of his collection in Dublin, donated the paintings to the National Gallery in London, but later changed his mind in a codicil in his will. Thus began a tussle over the ownership that has lasted over a century. However, in recent times, the galleries amicably share this bounty of great impressionist work. As Kay Sheehy found out when she went to view the new Vuillard in the Impressionist Gallery in the company of the Hugh Lane director, Barbara Dawson, and Chris Riopelle, curator of post-1800 paintings in the National Gallery of London.
So, Kay, we're now coming in through our exhibition, Sacred Trust, and into the Impressionist galleries, where you'll see some of the great paintings that are in the collection, several of which are shared with the National Gallery London. But also in this room we have the Vuillard La Cheminée, or the chimney piece, which Hugh Lane bought and had by 1908. And that is now accompanied by our new acquisition, the Vuillard Family, by Vuillard, which we acquired late last year, and it's just gone on show now.
And we've here with us Chris Riopelle, who is from the National Gallery. Chris, tell me about Vuillard and where he comes in terms of Impressionism.
Well, Vuillard is born in Burgundy in 1868. The family moves to Paris when he's nine, 1877. He then suddenly finds himself as a young man interested in art, studying at the Académie Julien, as it's called, where all of a sudden he's surrounded by other young artists also looking for new ways to paint, and they form quite a group. All of them very adventurous, and they call themselves the Nabi. It's a Hebrew word that means prophets. So already they're thinking, we are going to be looking forward into the future in our art. So he comes as a very young man, about 1890, into this ferment of the most avant-garde circle in Paris.
And when we think of Pierre Bonnard was another member of the Nabis, that we think of people with very intimate kind of domestic settings and uses of pattern.
Exactly. They took a number of them. They took family life, the domestic interior, day-to-day life as their subject matter, but treating it in an entirely new way. Big, bold colors, patterns across the surface, flatness. Moving away from grand scenes to something very intimate, very personal, but that at the same time had much wider implications.
So as you say, they were avant-garde, but Vuillard had a strong connection with Monet.
He and his friends very much respected that older generation, saw what they'd done particularly in taking control of their own careers. And these artists would do the same. This new generation would be very concerned to not rely on the state, not rely on other people to tell them how to do art, but they would find their own way. And in that regard, Monet, Degas, Renoir were great models.
This painting that Barbara and the gallery have acquired is a very intimate painting. To me, it looks quite abstract.
Yes.
So where does this come in the Nabi, you know, what we think we know of those painters, which is like intimate interiors with lots of patterns.
And bright colors. He is transitioning now. We're probably in the middle of 1900, 1910. The subject matter remains the same. It is a triple portrait, himself, his mother, Marie, his sister, Marie, all three of them seen up very close. We're right on top of them as they carry on their conversation in the family apartment. So it is the same subject matter, but now he's treating form in a very different way. The big bold colors are retreating, the flat patterning is retreating in favor of very quick touches of color across the surface. You really have to work to figure out what it is you're looking at. Suddenly it sort of pops. You see, that's the man, that's mama, that's the sister. But it's not right there immediately. You're called upon to interpret as you look. And it's this very interesting point of transition.
And do you think they wanted to go abstract? Do you think that they were no longer interested in figurative work, but maybe weren't bold enough to go the whole way?
No, I don't think it's a question of boldness, but I think it was a question of realizing that immediately recognizing something is not the point. The point is to get you to engage with the surface of the picture, get you working, as it were, in your own mind to recreate what they were doing. So representation is slipping away. They don't go all the way to abstraction yet, but they're in the neighborhood.
You can see the color palette here. You can make out heads, though maybe not faces so clearly. And then how does he paint that? Is that oil paint?
It is oil on board. You can see the board. It actually has rounded corners. He's probably working very quickly. He knows that it is an intimate family image. It probably was never going to be up for sale or anything like that. So he's doing it for himself and perhaps for his mother and his sister. They're the only people who are going probably to see it. And He's doing just enough, as it were, for them to recognize themselves.
And the fact that he has his mother and his sister here in terms of his biography, that's important because they live together.
They live together. He lived with his mother in various Paris apartments until she died at the age of 88. He was 61 at that point. This is a man who lived at home with mama until he was 61 years of age. So it was obviously very important to him, really central relationship of his life. His sister Marie did the same until she marrying a close friend of Vuillard himself. So that sense of intimacy, of all being one group, is essential to the meaning of the pictures.
Yes, because you get that in the painting. They're so grouped, they're almost, because it's slightly abstract or not clear, they kind of meld into each other.
Yes, yes. But he also gives us hints. Look, each of the three figures has their own palette. He is gray into black, mama is red, sister is blue. I say it has, in a funny way, it has the clarity of a flag.
There's another painting here. This is in the Hugh Lane collection, which you share with the Hugh Lane,
yes,
and the National Gallery in Britain. Will we have a look at that?
Yes.
Yeah. And this is this later again or around the same time? You say it's hard, Chris, to...
It's very hard to tell. We know the date of this because he very handily signs and dates this picture. He does not the one we've just been talking about. It's 1905. The one we've just been talking about, maybe 1905 as well. We don't know. He is transitioning. This picture, I think we can say, was painted for the market, was painted to be sold. It's a beguiling image of a chimney piece with flowers, with a picture, with bottles arrayed across the top of it. We know where it is. It is the summer home of his art dealer, a man named Essel, and he went there every summer. And it is a country picture because those are wild flowers in the vase, the kind you go out into the woods and pick. Very informal. But he brings it to a high degree of clarity. We know everything. There's no ambiguity in it the way there is self-consciously in the other picture. This is one of the most joyful pictures, you might even say, that Hugh Lane ever bought.
And for you now, as an expert, which one is more interesting to you, or is that an unfair question?
As a curator, I'm interested how much pleasure this picture of the chimney gives to people, and of course I utterly respect that. That is so important. The other one, in this way that it challenges us to figure out what's going on, forces us to spend a lot of time interpreting before it suddenly, as I say, pops and we get it. That aesthetically seems to me more provocative.
Chris, I know our listeners will want to know, what's the situation, Barbara's here as well, with the Lane bequest? It's good times for the Lane bequest that is shared between the Hugh Lane and the National Gallery in Britain.
Well, Kay, I think it's unique. We were discussing this yesterday. I think it's a unique agreement in the world between the two institutions. And we had a new Lane agreement in 2021. And we again share the paintings, particularly what we suppose call the superstars, which is maybe a little bit unfair. But we also have...
Superstars are the Parapluie and
the Impressionist painting, the Impressionist paintings, really, which are... which Lane really had a very good eye. He bought two superb Manets and Renoir, and we have Monets and the Vuillards. So these are shared equally between the two institutions, rotating at the moment every 5 years. But we also have expressed in the agreement more collaboration, conservation collaboration, you know, information sharing, scientific sharing. But also we hope to also organise exhibitions together and indeed more frequent loans for specific exhibitions.
Yes, we recognise that this was a very... history presented us with a great problem. And I think that after a century and more, we have come to a solution that is going to work. And that is to recognize joint ownership. and insist on constant communication, constant collaboration.
And there's no chance you're going to give them back to us full time.
But the joint ownership is important because now on all of the labelling and in catalogue entries, it is now that it is the National Gallery London in partnership with Hugh Lane Gallery Dublin. So Hugh Lane's original intent for Dublin is now stitched in and honoured in the acknowledgements. So the history rolls on, Kay. You never say never.
And can you tell us how much you paid for the Bulliard?
No, we couldn't, Kay.
I didn't think so. Chrissy
Barbara,
thank you so much.
You are very welcome.
The Edward Vyard painting, The Vyard Family, is on view at the Hugh Lane Gallery. Exactly 30 years ago this week, when Polish filmmaker Krzysztof Kieślowski premiered Three Colors Red, the final part of his landmark Three Colors sequence, it marked the completion of a most remarkable project in European cinema. The trilogy of films, Three Colors Blue, White and Red, reflected the thematic ideals underscored and guaranteed by the French Revolution, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, Liberty, Equality and Fraternity, while remaining pointedly apolitical in the telling of these stories. Three Colors Red premiered at Cannes in 1994 to critical acclaim, not only because the previous two films had been so well received, but also because Kieślowski announced that it would be his final film. Indeed, he died 2 years later at the age of just 54. Tonight we're joined by Stephen Benedict, who looks back at these three films and the career of this Polish auteur held in such high esteem by many in terms of filmmaking. It's a curious place to start, but we're going to start at the end.
Right, okay. Yeah.
We were starting with Three Colors Red, aren't we?
Yeah. You were saying there that his films, they examined the three essential ideals of the French Revolution, but they weren't political at all. They're apolitical. Mm. And the great thing about that is that in Red, what happens is there's a young lady called Valentine, played by Irène Jacob, and she's a young model, and she accidentally knocks down a dog in the street. And then she brings the dog back to the owner, who turns out to be a very elderly gentleman by the name of Joseph, played by Jean-Louis Trintignant, and he plays a retired judge. And then she discovers that he is eavesdropping on all the phone calls being made in the building in which he lives. And she's completely shocked and appalled by what he's doing. And yet a strange bond and connection develops between the two of them. And that is the way that Kieślowski examines the idea of fraternity. It is people from disparate backgrounds and differing positions finding an agreement.
Now, that's the story of Red.
Yeah.
But there was the disappointment in Cannes.
Yeah, yeah. The thing was, I mean, as you said, it was the third part in the trilogy. Blue had premiered at the Venice Film Festival the previous year and had won the Golden Lion. White had screened at the Berlin Festival and had won the Silver Bear. And so when it arrived in Cannes, there was great expectations. And the thing was, the organisers of Cannes that year made sure that the expectations were met, because it was the very, very first film to screen in competition. And it was rapturously received. And as this festival went on, everybody was saying, there isn't a film on the landscape here that can come in and steal the Palme d'Or. This is going to be the perfect summation and the crowning glory of Kieślowski's career. He's about to retire. This will be brilliant. And then on the Saturday morning before the Monday closing ceremony, Quentin Tarantino thunders into town with Pulp Fiction and stole the Palme d'Or. Well, it didn't steal the Palme d'Or. I believe it deserved the Palme d'Or that night. It was the best film. And you can see in the 30 years since how cinema, it has changed cinema. But I think looking back, it is to the eternal embarrassment of the jury that they didn't
give him something.
They didn't give him one award. In the Polish word, nice. He got nothing. And I think that was to the eternal embarrassment of the Cannes jury that year.
All right. Well, we will be talking, surprise, surprise, about Pulp Fiction and the big splash that it made. That'll be with John McGuire tomorrow night on the programme. But let's stick with Kieślowski. He never gave any interviews in English.
No, he felt that his English wasn't good enough. So he spoke in Polish or French.
Mm. Yes. So, but we do have an interview with Irène Jacob.
Okay.
Irène,
yes.
Isn't she? Irène Jacob from Red.
Yes.
And here she is talking about working with the great Polish director.
Working together was a very good collaboration. It's true that he had a very precise idea of what he wanted, but at the same time, you felt quite free in that field. His career started as a documentary filmmaker, and he's done many, many documentaries. And he said that if he stopped doing documentaries, is that because what really interested him, finally, was filming something very intimate in people, and he felt he didn't have the right to film these people when it was their real story, and he would rather have actors that were just acting. But he realized that it was these subtle feelings he wanted to touch, these intimate feelings. So when I say that he wanted to film intimacy, it's the intimacy within ourselves already. How do we connect with the world? You know, how do we suddenly feel we belong to something because we see a coincidence here? Or all these things are big forces driving us, even if they are very subtle.
There you go. That's Irene Jakub talking about playing the part of Valentin and working with the Polish film director Krzysztof Kieślowski, who we're celebrating this evening on Arena. Interesting that she talks there about this background that he had in documentary film, and that he had some kind of as a documentary maker, he had real ethical qualms about getting the intimate details of a real person's life.
Yeah, and I think part of that is because it's the way he approached then the issues that he addressed, the themes that he addressed in his films. He did so obliquely. He never really revealed his hand. As I was saying to you in Three Colors Red, it's oblique. It's about the way it addresses fraternity. And I think that for me, I mean, Irene Jakub, there was the second time working with Kieślowski because they previously collaborated a couple of years earlier in 1991 on what I think is his best film, The Double Life of Veronique. And for me, that's a typical example of the best example of how apolitical he was. The movie it opens up in Warsaw. It's about a young singer, an aspiring singer, played by Irene Jakub. Her name is Veronica. And she's walking through the square in Warsaw one afternoon. She sees a group of students, and they're French students, and one of them looks exactly like her. And then she dies very, very quickly. And then the movie switches to France and follows the very same woman with the very same name. She's a student
That's how we get the double up. But let's not veer too far from the trilogy that we want to celebrate. We've had the essence of what is within Red there. Blue, Juliette Binoche in Blue, I think is for many people the one that really sticks out.
I think so. Yeah, I think it's the most successful of the lot. And also the great thing is that if you're ever confused as to which one you're watching, it's all very colour-coded. There's a lot of blue in the Juliette Binoche episode. But the great thing about that movie is because they're examining liberty. Mm. And again, he doesn't do it politically. What she is suffering from, her husband and child have been killed in a car crash. So the journey that she goes on is not a political journey. It's the liberation from grief. So that's the way he's examining the themes. And as I said, they're not political at all. The great thing about the stories is they're not laden down with political tracks or polemics.
And given that he had such qualms about the documentary nature of things, it's interesting to hear Juliette Binoche talk about how she felt about being cast in this film, Blue.
When I read the script, you know, I was amazed in a way that he proposed me to play this character because of a very close friend of mine had the same kind of story somehow, because she lost her son and husband, not in a car accident, but in different circumstances. And of course, because I helped this friend, you know, try to come back to life somehow, was completely related to that story because of the friendship I had with this woman. There was a question at a certain moment, because Spielberg just asked me for Jurassic Park, and I wanted to work with Spielberg at the same time. I felt so related to Blue somehow, so there was a moment I had to make my decision, and so that was it. The first time we met, it was all about philosophy questions about life, death, you know, immediately, without a second, it was like that. And at the time, he didn't speak that much of English. So I felt a little frustrated because there was a translator. And I like to have direct contact, of course. And so then in Blue, he was ready.
There you go, Julia Binoche talking about three colours, blue in that particular case, the Kieślowski film. Stephen Benedict celebrating the trilogy with me in studio this evening. And as you said, there's blue, like you get a little blue cloth out of the car when there's the accident, when that happens.
Yeah.
Blue seeps in on top of it. There's blue light regularly.
Swimming pool, and
it
beads.
It tells us everything. The colours tell us everything. What about white, which many people say is the kind of disaster of
the
trilogy?
Well, it's the middle.
Is that too strong?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit strong, but it's the weak middle one, sort of like the second album you've opened up very. But the amazing thing is the coincidence that you heard the Julia Binoche talking about that. He made a movie called Blind Chance. It was about a young medical student, and he's running to catch a train. And if he catches the train, his future will be different. If he misses the train, it'll be a different direction. And he tells a story.
Sliding Doors, isn't it?
That's very well spotted. And I think the great thing about Kieślowski was he never explained anything. He sort of left it up to you to discover it. And when you discover the meaning, the connections between the stories, it's really, really satisfying because you feel very smart. It's not like it's being spoon-fed to you by sliding doors.
And finally, on White, why is it considered the weakest?
Comedy wasn't his strong point. He considered himself a pessimist. Now, this is an indication of Kieślowski's sense of humour. He said, "My pessimism is my greatest characteristic." So the comedy in White doesn't really, really work.
Maybe if that's his best joke, maybe we can see why comedy doesn't work. Okay, Krzysztof Kieślowski was the Polish director we've been speaking about, and specifically the three colours sequence of movie Red, White and Blue with Stephen Benedict. That is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy and Barbara Sanwell were the researchers. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.